Today we're going to continue our series on David. This is the third of four. Next week will be the last one. And as we've seen the heroic David. We've seen the heroic Abigail. We've seen how David responded sometimes as he was learning in the wilderness, sometimes how he responded in a poor way. Today we're going to talk more about David's growth. And as David grew, he had to learn a lot of things in the wilderness, but then learning something is great. It's applying it is what's going to make the huge difference. And I believe that perhaps the greatest measure of a person's individual maturity is how we handle authority, power, and influence when it's given to us. And we all have it in some way, shape, or form. In other words, how we respond when it dawns on us that we are the most powerful person in the room at that time. Whether it's at work, whether it's at home, when the moment hits that all eyes are on me and I'm the one in charge, I'm the one making the decision, what we choose to do in that moment, that says so much about me, because one of the greatest reflections of our individual maturity is how we respond when these situations arise. And few things are more disturbing than when we see someone with power, influence, and authority, and they leverage it for their own benefit. They neglect the people that they're responsible for, and to those people that have chosen to follow them. But at the same time, on the opposite side of this, there's nothing more inspiring than when we see somebody with that power, that influence, that authority, and they say no to themselves. They say no to something that they could embrace for the sake of the people that they are responsible for people that have chosen to follow them. Some of our favorite stories that we hear throughout all time, whether biblical or non-biblical, is when men or women have chosen to say no to themselves and yes to the people that have chosen to follow them. And my theory is this, that I don't really believe that we know what lever that we will pull or what button that we will push until we're actually handed the keys. It's just kind of a thought process. Maybe we can daydream it out, but we don't actually know what's going to happen until it's given to us, until we are actually given the position that comes with that power and that authority and that influence. Or in David's case, until he's given the crown. Now, when David was a little boy, maybe I shouldn't say little boy, this was more of when David was about a middle schooler. So when David was a middle schooler, Samuel the prophet, who again was kind of the authority besides King Saul, he showed up at David's home, and David wasn't home at that time, he was out working. And Samuel showed up at David's home and said to David's father, Jesse, he said, "I'm here on a mission." But as we would discover later, this was going to be a secret mission. And the reason it was secret is because Samuel's mission was to anoint the next king of Israel. And the reason that this was a secret is because Israel already had a king. So if you're going to anoint the next king where there's still a king, it better be a secret mission. So he just shows up, and he doesn't even tell Jesse why he's there. He says, "Jesse, I've come here for a special sacrifice, and I want you to invite all of your family to the special sacrifice." And the idea was this, that Samuel thought that as soon as I see the son of Jesse that's going to be the next king, I'm going to get that God nod. I'm just going to know that this is the guy. And we know the story, right? Jesse invites all of his family to that special sacrifice. Samuel's scanning the crowd. He's trying to figure out which one of these folks is going to be the next king. And then the text says this, "When Jesse arrived, Samuel saw Eliab, which was Jesse's oldest son, his firstborn." And, you know, in situations like this, you typically go to the firstborn. "And thought, surely the Lord's anointed stands here before the Lord." He thought, this is easy. We got a firstborn, the first kid. We don't even have to do the sacrifice. Game over. I got this one figured out. "But the Lord said to Samuel, do not consider his appearance," which is very difficult for us, right? When we meet somebody for the very first time, we don't notice their IQ, we don't notice their manners, we notice their appearance first. And all of us, even in ancient times, we ascribed value and authority to people who look good. Why? And we learned something important that why God said to Samuel, "Do not consider his appearance or his height, for I have rejected him." The Lord does not look at the things people look at. People look at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart. In other words, it's what's inside of a person that matters, not the outside. And so the story goes on, and six sons later, still no king. And all the sons are there. They're starting the sacrifice, and Samuel's looking around like, maybe I missed something here. And he says to Jesse, and just imagine this awkward moment. He's like, "Jesse, Are these all the sons you have? I mean, I asked you to invite the whole family. Is this everybody? I mean, it seems like a silly question, right? Then Jesse looks around, though, and he's like, oh, wait, no, this isn't everybody. There is still the youngest, Jesse answered. He is tending the sheep. Then Samuel said, send for him right now. We're not going to sit down until he arrives. And when David shows up, you know, this little shepherd boy who probably was around 13, 14, middle school years at that time, Samuel gets the nod. God said to Samuel, and however God may have said it, he's the one. He said, rise and anoint him. This is the one. And then this strange thing happens where, and just imagine when you were 13, 14 years old, this guy walks up to you, he pours oil on his head, he gives him a blessing, and then he packs his stuff up and leaves. The whole family's standing there like, what just happened? Because there's no indication in any of the text here that Samuel told Jesse what he anointed David to do. But here's what we do know. Since he was a little boy, since David was a middle schooler, David knew God had something special for him. And about 18 months from that moment, maybe 2 years from that moment, that's when he kills Goliath, and David's an overnight sensation. And for the next 7 years, things are great. And as we saw last week, after 7 years, David falls out of favor with King Saul. And David becomes a fugitive from the law for 8 years. And so David's on the run for the next 8 years, hiding with his band of merry men, trying not to side with the Philistines, but at the same time trying to stay away from all of King Saul's people and everyone who supports King Saul. All the while knowing that God had chosen him for something special. And all the while, when you read through this incredible detailed narrative, all the while learning some extraordinary important lessons. And perhaps the most important lesson David learned in the wilderness was this lesson, that it's not about me. It's about God's will, God's way, and God's time. And the interesting thing with this too, and the narrative is just so fascinating, on two occasions, David actually has the opportunity to kill King Saul. And if he kills him, he becomes king. One of the more famous occasions where David is hiding in the cave and King Saul's men are passing by. And David is going to wait for King Saul's men to pass by, and then he's going to come out of the cave and go the opposite direction. And right in front of the cave where David is hiding, I mean, how many caves are around there? Right in front of the one David was hiding in, King Saul had to go to the bathroom. And this is literally, I think, the only account where it talks references in the Bible about someone having to go to the bathroom. So King Saul has to go to the bathroom. He stops, he gets off his donkey, and he goes in the cave where David is hiding with his men. You know, their eyes have adjusted to the darkness, King Saul's has not. And Saul stops at the mouth of the cave, just beyond the point where anyone could see him, and he begins to go to the bathroom. He's in, like, you know, the most vulnerable position he could possibly be in. And all of David's men turn right away to him and say, and these are my words, not theirs, are you kidding me? God just delivered your enemy into your hands. In fact, this is the day the Lord spoke of when he said to you, I will give your enemy into your hands for you to deal with as you wish. And David almost falls for this. You may remember this story. He creeps up on King Saul. He's about to kill the King Saul. And he walks out of the cave victorious, and knowing that immediately all of King Saul's army would surrender and declare David the king. And as David is just about to kill King Saul, he realizes, no. I will not take matters into my own hands. So Saul finishes up. He goes, gets out on a donkey, and there, you know, he's about to leave, and David appears in the mouth of the cave. And at that moment, everybody in Saul's army knows that he could have taken the king's life, but he chose not to. But David's a bit mischievous in this, as we're about to find out. He walks out to the mouth of the cave, and he's like, yoo-hoo! No, maybe not exactly like that, but he gets everybody's attention in David's way. And he said, hey, Saul, and everybody looks, and there's David. May the Lord judge between you and me, and may the Lord avenge the wrongs you have done to me, but my hand will not touch you. Although everybody behind me and everybody in front of me knows that I have every right to take your life, to defend my home. And then there's another story. It's not so popular, and this is a few months later. Saul and his army are in the desert as if. It's just like this wide open plain with rolling hills. There's virtually no trees. David had sent spies out to track Saul's progress, and the sun goes down. King Saul did what kings always do as the sun goes down. He decided to spend the night right in the middle of his army. So he's completely surrounded by about 3,000 men. His spear's in the ground by his head because that's how they slept. And as the sun went down, David couldn't resist. And he turns to his friend Abishai and he says, "Abishai, I have a really bad idea. Would you be willing to join me in my really bad idea?" Abishai says, "Absolutely, let's do this." So David and Abishai went to the army by night, and there was Saul, lying asleep inside the camp with his spear stuck in the ground near his head. Abner is the chief of the king's bodyguards. He's the one that's responsible for protecting King Saul. Abner and his soldiers were lying around him, and Abishai said to David, and I think he whispered because it's night, 3,000 men, they're right smack dab in the middle. I mean, just think of this. There they are sneaking down into Saul's camp in the middle of the night. I mean, you know, what are you thinking? And Abishai whispers into David's ear, "Today God has delivered your enemy into your hands. We miss this opportunity once, okay? Now it's time to power up. Now it's time to take what's yours. God wills it. God wills it. God wills it." It's that little voice in his ear that keeps going off. I mean, how else can you explain how we are standing in the middle of King Saul's army and no one has detected us? We are standing next to King Saul. Then Abishai says, "Now look, David, I know you have all these religious convictions. You cannot lay your hands on the Lord's anointed, but God hasn't told me that. So let me pin him to the ground with one thrust of the spear. I won't strike him twice." In other words, David, okay, I know that you're all worried about this because he's the king. Just let me kill him. I won't even mangle his body. Imagine this, David. I will take his spear, I will put it right through his heart. At that moment, his eyes are going to open up and you're going to be the last person that he sees on this earth. But David whispered back to Abishai, "Don't destroy him. Who can lay a hand on the Lord's anointed and be guiltless? I refuse," and this is a big deal for us, "I refuse to violate," David would say, "the will of God in order to gain the blessing of God. I will not violate the will of God in order to gain the promise of God. I am not going to violate the will of God to get what I deserve. This is not about me." And then David and his men, they melt back into the desert because David refused, and this is important, David refused to replace what God had put in place. Why? God's will, God's way, and God's time. It's got to be God's will and God's way and God's time. And I'm skipping over a lot here, but eventually King Saul and his son Jonathan are killed by the Philistines in battle. The two men that stood in the way of David becoming the king, they're now dead. And so the tribe of Judah, you know, Israel had 12 tribes. The tribe of Judah, which was the tribe David was from, they declared him king. But then came along a fella named Ishbosheth, who is one of King Saul's other sons. He declares himself king. So Ishbosheth, because he's the king of King Saul, or the son of King Saul, he claims to be king over 11 tribes. So David thought, these two are dead. I'm now the king of everything. And then God pulls that away again, it seems, because Ishbosheth steps in and takes 11 tribes, and David's only over one. And for 7 more long years, there's this conflict between the house of David and the house of King Saul. Then eventually through this conflict, David just essentially tries to stay out of the way. People will continually say to David, "Claim what's yours," over and over and over again, that little nagging voice that we all have in our ear. And David continually says, "No, it's God's will, God's way, and God's time. I will not lay my hand on the Lord's anointed," and Ishbosheth has been declared by those 11 tribes, then he's the king. I need to stay out of the way. 7 years this goes on. Sometimes we get upset when our prayers aren't answered the next day. 7 years this has gone on. And then finally, two brothers sneak into Ishbosheth's house while he's taking a nap, and they murder him in his sleep. And they think that they've done a great thing. because now they have removed the last obstacle for David to become the king. And now David can be the king over the entire nation, not just one tribe. The last obstacle has been removed, and here's what the text says. It says, they brought the head of Ishbosheth to David at Hebron and said to the king, here is the head of Ishbosheth, son of Saul, your enemy who tried to kill you. So they present David this head. You know they're excited. You know, they're bumping elbows. They're so proud of themselves. They think they did a great job. But David had a different answer for them. He says, Rechab and his brother Baana, as surely as the Lord lives, who has delivered me out of every trouble, when someone told me Saul is dead and thought he was bringing me good news, I seized him and put him to death. I skipped that part of the story. That was the reward I gave him for his news. Now they're not so happy. How much more when wicked men have killed an innocent man in his own house and on his own bed? At which point the people around David are saying, how can you say that Ishbosheth is an innocent man? He's claiming the kingdom that belongs to you. But in David's mind, that's not how he thought. Remember, David is, it's God's will, God's way, and God's time. So David gave an order to his men, and they killed them, the two brothers. But they took the head of Ishbosheth and buried it. That's a sign of honor back in those days. And they buried it in Abner's tomb at Hebron. So, well, after Ishbosheth was dead and the whole demise, the other 11 tribes, they finally declared David king. And at last, finally, in our story, David would become the king of the entire nation. And when all the elders of Israel from all 12 tribes had come to King David at Hebron to crown him, to hand him the power, in that moment, this is when David shows his true greatness. In this moment, David applies everything that he has learned in the wilderness. In that moment, he shows extraordinary maturity. Maturity that he would not have had at 15 or 20, or as we saw, not at 22. But the difficult lessons he learned hiding and running from King Saul in this moment, he would apply them and show his greatness. Think about this. They are about to hand him the power. He's holding all the cards. His word is law. He already had all of the influence, then he's the most powerful person in the room, even without the crown. And in this moment, the text tells us that King David made a covenant with them at Hebron. Now, a covenant in our way of thinking is kind of like a contract, but that's not what a covenant was. And in this context, it's I'll do this if you'll do this. If you'll do this, I'll do this for you. It was more of an arrangement. It was an agreement that King David made promises to the people, and this was completely unnecessary. He did not need to do this. He was now the king. His word was law. So why in the world, after being mistreated all of those years, and again, he's facing a group of elders who did not support him when he was on the run. He could have exacted a vengeance on every single one of those elders, except for the ones that were from the tribe of Judah, but he didn't. Instead, he made a covenant with the people. Why? Well, the text, the last three words of the text explain it all. And this is the point of the story. It says, when all the elders of Israel had come to King David at Hebron, the king made a covenant with them at Hebron before the Lord. See, in this moment, and this is so powerful, David recognized in public that he would be a king under authority. This wasn't something that was common in those times. He's the first. In this moment, he submitted himself to God's law, which meant as a leader, he was submitting himself to the people over which he would rule. This was his way of saying, I am a king, but I am not the king. Because as we said in the first part of our series, with all of David's ups and downs and all of his flaws, David never confused himself with the king of Israel. And they anointed him king over Israel. And David was 30 years old when he became king, and he reigned over Israel for 40 years. And so we're going to pick this story up right here Next week when we come in, we're not done, so don't everybody get their antsy pants on. Next week we're going to take this story to the end. So you're not going to want to miss next week, because this is the last one, and we're going to take this that all the way, but that's the point we're going to pick up next year's his reign. But here's the point of today. David waited, and this is amazing. David waited 15 years for God to give him what he had promised, and not an easy 15 years. David waited 15 years for God to give him what he had promised. Some of us have a hard time waiting 15 minutes, 15 days. Maybe we say we have something to do. We have a plan that we have there for 3 years, and we get to 3 years, and it's not there. 15 hard years. David waited. And during that time, he learned the extraordinary lessons that make him a good and right king. He learned that leadership is always a stewardship. And even kings are accountable. There's nobody that's outside of this. And while this is very inspiring, and I think that if you're a leader or a boss or an aspiring leader, certainly read the story. And again, I've skipped some details. But certainly you read this story, and there's something inspiring about it. But here's the thing. It is not really enough for us to be inspired whenever we see someone doing the right thing. And as I said up front, whenever we see a leader say no to themselves so that they can say yes to the people that they are leading, it's always inspiring. But if you're a Christian, it's not enough for us just to be inspired. That kind of greatness is actually required of us as Christians. And here's why I say that, and this is so cool. 1,000 years later, imagine that. It's almost impossible for us to imagine 1,000 years later. But 1,000 years later, 20 miles north of Hebron, 20 miles north from where all of this took place, in the city of Jerusalem, Jesus would model this kind of greatness. And he would do this in the most unusual way, but there would be a twist on how he would do it. Here's what happened. So John, who was there, he witnessed all of these things. He wrote about this incredible moment when Jesus modeled that what David had modeled, but what Jesus had modeled with a twist. It was just before the Passover festival, and the Passover festival is when the Jewish people would celebrate annually the moment or the time when God led the nation out of Egyptian slavery. And Jesus, during this Passover, and this would be his last Passover with his disciples, he gathered in what's referred to as the upper room. And this is a special room where they would meet for the Passover meal. And so they're finishing up the Passover meal, and John, who I'm sure would interview all this detail out of Jesus later, because what happened the next moment was so fascinating. John, who was there, says this, that somehow Jesus knew that the hour had come for him to leave this world and go to the Father. Jesus knows that in just a few hours, he's going to be arrested, he's going to be tried, and he's going to be crucified. And like David, he's been anointed by God, but not recognized. And like David, during this meal, he would inaugurate a brand new covenant. But not between God and the 12 tribes of Israel. He would introduce a brand new covenant between God and all of mankind. But not through the blood of an animal, but through his own blood. And in this moment, and this is like a hinge moment in history, between the time when Jesus worked and functioned as a Jewish rabbi and a miracle worker, to the moment when it dawns on him in some crazy, mysterious way. But in this moment, he recognized that the end had come. He recognized that this is a very special moment. And here's what John said. Jesus knew that the Father had put all things under his power and that he had come from God and was returning to God. See, in this moment, Jesus had all the power without the crown. He had all the authority without the title. He's holding all the cards, and he recognized that God has put all things under his authority, and John tells us he got up. And here's a question. What do you do when you're the most powerful man, most powerful, influential person in the room? When you're a king, what do you do? He got up from his meal, took off his outer clothing, and wrapped a towel around his waist. And the disciples, they just couldn't believe it. There's so much emotion in this room at this time. There's like this moan and this groan going on. In fact, Peter would say, no, you're not doing that. He knew what Jesus was doing. He said, you're not doing that. We have people for that. We have slaves for that. We have servants for that. Put your clothes back on. You are not going to do what it looks like you are about to do. You are not about to wash our feet. You're a rabbi. You're our teacher. Besides, we've seen what you can do with those hands, and you are not about to use those hands to wash our feet. And in my imagination, Jesus just smiled and ignored him. And after that, the text tells us he poured water into a basin and began to wash the disciples' feet, drying them with a towel that was wrapped around him. And then he puts his robe back on that showed, yes, he was a rabbi, and yes, he had authority, and he sat down. And I believe after he did all that, he sat down with that big grin on his face again. And I think nobody said a word. Jesus didn't say a word. He didn't need to say anything. He just preached the most powerful lesson that he would ever preach to that group of people. He had just done something that was obvious what he meant by what he just did. He didn't need to say anything, but he did. And I don't know, maybe it was for me, for my sake, maybe it's for your sake. He says now that I, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also should wash one another's feet. I have set you an example that you should do as I have done for you. If I'm not too good to wash your feet, then you are not too good to wash one another's feet. And I think it's important for us not to read this and think we need to go start washing everybody's feet. Okay, that's not what this story is about. This is not a rule that was set forth that we should wash feet because Jesus washed feet. And we are just to be, we're to be like him, so also I have to just go wash feet because that's what Jesus did? No. That would be missing the point of the entire story, and actually many like it in the Bible. This is a story of Jesus doing what he needed to do with what he had in the particular space that he was in. He didn't need more. He didn't need less. He was given the authority, the power by God, and he chose to humble himself in that moment, not take advantage of the moment for his own gain and glory. He modeled for us what we are to do when we all have the power in the room, not wash feet, but to be humble when we are given the keys. And I think it's important to realize that at some level and in some capacity, somebody has already handed us the keys. Because we all have a title. For somebody, you wear a crown. You're a father, you're a mother, you're a husband, you're a wife, you're an owner, a manager, a captain of the team. Maybe you're the big brother or the big sister. You have authority. And we all would do well to embrace what David learned the hard way that Jesus modeled for us. That when we are the most powerful person in the room, that we leverage our power for the benefit of the other people in the room, not ourselves. This is what David learned in the desert. This is what Jesus modeled for us in the upper room. And as Christians, this is required of us. I mean, after all, for the Son, even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and give his life as a ransom for many. Imagine if all of us with influence led that way. Imagine if all of us lived that way. History tells us that that kind of selflessness changed the world once. And perhaps it could again. So if you're here today and you're a Christian, and this is something that you've struggled with, this is something that you've put behind you because you thought maybe it's not that important, it is. We're instructed to live a particular way. And if you're here today and you're not a Christian, and you're thinking, boy, this story sounds all too familiar for how I've grown up, the way I was treated, the way I treated others, and I want to correct that. Guys, the front, sometimes it seems so intimidating, but the front has nothing special except people that will pray with you, people that can help you through and pray through problems, pray through issues that you're going through, pray for strength. So as we sing our invitation song, if you want to come up front, I know I'm just one person, you think you might overwhelm me, but I'm pretty good at it with praying. And if too many people get up here, there's a room full of elders that would be more than happy to pray with you. So won't you come forward this morning and let's work out some of these details. Let's let history redefine itself again. It was once a selflessness way. And if we lived a selflessness way again, perhaps the world could change again.